up. I ain't mad, VOA1. The hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Thailand's government has canceled an emergency order that failed to end continuing pro-democracy demonstrations. The state of emergency was declared last week. It banned public gatherings of more than four people. It also permitted censorship of the media and gave police powers to detain people temporarily without charge. But daily protests continued in Bangkok and other cities even with the emergency order in place. The order was lifted at 12 p.m. on Thursday. A government statement said it was canceled because the current situation that led to the announcement of the severe situation had eased. Government officials and state agencies were told to deal with ongoing events with existing laws, the statement said. The protesters are demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha. He is a former army general who has led the country under military rule since his group seized power in 2014. The protesters are also pushing for changes to the constitution and reforms of the country's monarchy. Prayut went on national television Wednesday night to appeal to protesters to reduce political tensions. "I will make the first move to de-escalate this situation," he said. "I am currently preparing to lift the state of severe emergency in Bangkok and will do so promptly if there are no violent incidents." As he spoke, protesters marched near Government House, the place of his office, to demand that he step down. They also called for the release of activists arrested in connection with earlier demonstrations. Protest leaders said that withdrawing the emergency order was not enough. Prayut is still seeking to stay in power while ignoring all the people's demands. The emergency decree shouldn't have been issued in the first place, said Sirawit Sirituat, one of the leaders of the pro-democracy movement. The demonstrators said if their demands were not met, they would return in 3 days. There were no large demonstrations on Thursday, as some protesters said they were taking a day to rest. Wednesday had marked the 8th straight day of protests. On Tuesday, the government approved a request to call a special meeting of Parliament next week to seek to find a solution to the political crisis. But the pro-democracy movement has so far not shown much interest in a parliamentary solution. Prayut's supporters hold a majority in parliament. The order's cancellation came as a Bangkok court was preparing to rule on legal motions to force the government to end the order on the basis that it illegally restricted freedom of assembly. The government suffered a legal setback Wednesday when a judge barred it from carrying out orders to ban several media companies for failing to obey rules under the emergency order. A police order permitted officials to block news websites that published what was described as distorted information. In Geneva, the United Nations Human Rights Office said its experts had urged Thailand's government to honor the rights of peaceful assembly and free speech. The UN statement said Thai people should be permitted to freely speak their mind and share their political views, both online and offline, without prosecution. I'm Brian Lynn.
Of mine had a very small wedding last weekend. Only close family attended in person. Everyone else, myself included, watched the ceremony in real time on YouTube. My friend, the bride, looked very, very pretty. She and her new husband were very happy. And I was very glad to see them take this step together. You probably noticed that I used the word very repeatedly in my story. I did it to demonstrate this point. Rather than repeat an intensifier too often, we can usually choose stronger adjectives. We call the strongest adjectives non-gradable or extreme adjectives. Extreme adjectives are the subject of today's Everyday Grammar program. An adjective is a word that describes the qualities of a noun. Most adjectives in English are gradable. There can be different levels to their qualities. Take the word funny, which is a gradable adjective. Someone or something can be, for example, kind of funny, pretty funny, very funny, or extremely funny. I used adverbs such as kind of and pretty to show how strong or weak the humor is. Extreme adjectives work a bit differently. They are words that mean extremely plus adjective. For example, the adjective hilarious means extremely funny. Generally, we do not say someone or something is kind of hilarious or very hilarious because hilarious itself already expresses the idea of being extremely funny. As an English learner, you probably already know some extreme adjectives. Here are a few common ones.
Exhausted, which means extremely tired.
Excellent, which means extremely good.
Freezing, which means extremely cold.
Delicious, which means extremely tasty.
Huge, which means extremely large.
With extreme adjectives, there are a few basic rules. However, English is a constantly evolving language, so exceptions to these rules continue to grow. With that in mind, let's discuss the first rule. Gradable adjectives have comparative and superlative forms, while extreme adjectives usually do not. Here are some examples for gradable adjectives. Funny, funnier, the funniest. Good, better, the best. And tasty, tastier, the tastiest. Some people might say, for example, this dish is tastier than that one, or it is the tastiest dish I have ever had. With extreme adjectives, we usually avoid comparatives and superlatives. The adjective excellent is an example. It means extremely good. Native speakers generally would not say, this show is more excellent than that one, or it is the most excellent show. But over the years, spoken English has influenced grammar rules. So you might hear some extreme adjectives in comparative or superlative form. Take the adjective delicious. A person might say, this is the most delicious dish I have ever had. It would not be considered wrong, even in written English. Knowing which extreme adjectives have these exceptions comes with time and experience. It is not something to memorize from a list. Now let's talk about the second rule. With extreme adjectives, we avoid using most adverbs that suggest varying degree or level. Many adverbs express the degree of a gradable adjective. You heard some earlier, such as kind of in kind of funny and very in very good. Other common ones include a bit, a little, and rather. For instance, you could say, her house is a bit cold, or that story is rather dull. The words cold and dull are gradable adjectives. But with extreme adjectives, we often avoid using these adverbs. For example, it might sound strange to say, her house is a bit freezing, or that man is rather gorgeous. Yet, we can use other adverbs with extreme adjectives for stronger emphasis. Generally, adverbs that express the meaning of totality are used with extreme adjectives. Some examples are totally, utterly, absolutely, and completely. Listen to how they are used in sentences.
That comedian is absolutely hilarious.
I am totally exhausted.
The rug looks completely filthy.
Now, on to rule number 3. This is more of an exception to rule number 2. Only a few adverbs can be used with both gradable adjectives and non-gradable or extreme adjectives. They include pretty, really, so, and fairly. Listen to these speakers using a couple of these adverbs with both gradable and non-gradable adjectives.
My parents are pretty tired. My parents are pretty exhausted.
This painting is so nice. This painting is so beautiful.
So, what can you do with the information you learned today? Here is something you might enjoy. Choose a day to focus on adjectives. On that day, listen and look for adjectives wherever English is used. When you hear or see one, ask yourself if it is gradable or extreme and if an adverb is used with it. Write down the sentence you heard or saw the words in and note where you found them. This will help you remember them better later on. I'm Alice Bryant.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1820s, in the state of New York, a man named Joseph Smith started the Mormon religion. Smith based it on what he said were God's words to the ancient people of America. Many people became members of the new church. Others, however, laughed at some of the beliefs of the Mormons. This led to trouble. Smith had to move his people many times. For a while, they settled in the state of Illinois, in a town they built and called Nauvoo. The church split when Joseph Smith said that Mormons could have more than one wife. The split led to violence and public opposition to the Mormons. Smith was arrested and put in jail. A mob attacked the jail and killed Smith and his brother. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave the state. This week on our series, Sarah Long and Richard Rail discuss relations between the Mormons and the federal government.
Brigham Young became the new leader of the Mormons. He told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said it was a wide, beautiful valley in the west. He said he would recognize it when he saw it. The Mormons left Illinois in the spring of 1846. There were more than 15,000 people and many wagons and farm animals. The trip west was hard. Many of the people died. After months of slow travel, they stopped to make their winter camp.
Explorers visited the camp. They told Brigham Young about a great salt lake in a wide valley on the western side of the Rocky Mountains. From the way they described it, Young believed it was the valley of his dream. He started to move his people toward the Great Salt Lake as soon as the winter snows melted. They arrived in the summer of 1847. Brigham Young looked out over the valley. "This," he said, "is the right place."
The Mormons wasted no time. 2 hours after arriving, they began to prepare the ground for planting. The lake water was too salty to use, so they built a system of canals to bring water down from the mountains. The first few years were difficult. Cold weather and insects destroyed their crops. Yet the Mormons continued to work hard to make their settlement a success. They refused to think of leaving.
At first, the Mormons were ruled only by the laws of their church and by their leader. Then gold was discovered in California. Many non-Mormons passed through the Salt Lake area on their way to the gold fields. Some of them stayed. It soon became clear that new laws were needed to govern the growing population. The Mormons asked Congress to approve a territorial government for their land. They called the land Deseret. That was a Mormon word meaning honeybee. The Mormons claimed a large area. It stretched from the mountains of Colorado west to the mountains of California, from Arizona north to Oregon.
Congress rejected the large claim of Deseret and made it a much smaller territory. It also refused to accept the name Deseret. Instead, Congress called it Utah, after the Ute tribe of Native American Indians that lived there. As a compromise, Brigham Young was named governor of the new Utah Territory. Most of the new territorial officials were Mormons, too. Four were not Mormon.
Governing the territory would not be easy. There were disputes during the administrations of several American presidents. As a result of one dispute, the four non-Mormon officials returned to Washington. The Mormons then formed their own territorial government with a legislature and courts. Other federal officials were sent to Utah. Some of them were not prepared for the job. Usually, they did not stay long.
Some of the officials made many charges against Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders. They said Mormons refused to recognize the power of the federal government. They said Mormons put the words of Young above the laws of Congress. They said the church had a secret organization to take the lives and property of those who questioned the power of the church. There were charges that Mormons had burned the papers of the Supreme Court of the territory. And there were charges that Mormons were responsible for Indian attacks on some officials. President Franklin Pierce decided he should make someone else governor of Utah. The man he chose, however, did not want the job. Instead, he urged the president to let Brigham Young remain. President Pierce agreed.
Relations between the Mormons and the government did not improve in the next 3 years. Territorial officials resigned. They charged that the Mormons were in open rebellion against the federal government. The next president, James Buchanan, dismissed Brigham Young as governor. He ordered more than 1,000 soldiers to go to Utah to put down the rebellion. He also sent a new governor, Alfred Cumming, with the soldiers. The Mormons prepared to fight. A small group of Mormon men attacked and destroyed the army's supply wagons. They forced the soldiers to stop for the winter before reaching the Salt Lake Valley. The soldiers could do nothing until spring.
In Washington, efforts were made to settle the dispute. A man named Thomas Kane asked President Buchanan to let him go to Utah. Kane was an old friend of the president. He also was a friend of the Mormons. He had spent much time with them during their long trip to Utah 10 years earlier. Kane feared what might happen to his Mormon friends if fighting started. He told President Buchanan that he did not want a job or money. He only wanted a chance to be useful. The president agreed to let him try to settle the dispute.
Thomas Kane arrived in Salt Lake City, the territorial capital, early in 1858. He found that the Mormons had decided not to fight. Instead, they were preparing to search for a new home. They talked of moving to Mexico, or perhaps to an island in the South Pacific. Kane talked with Brigham Young. Then he went to the army camp to talk with Governor Cumming. The governor agreed to go to Salt Lake City with Kane. The two men went alone, without any soldiers.
The Mormons welcomed Cumming, but continued their preparations to leave. Cumming called a public meeting. He said he was in Utah to represent the federal government. He said he was there to make sure the people of the territory obeyed the Constitution and the laws of the United States. He said he would not use military force until every other way had failed. Above all, said Cumming, he would not interfere with the Mormon religion. He urged the Mormons not to leave the land they had worked so hard to build. Brigham Young agreed to stay.
Governor Cumming returned to the army camp. He told the commander that the Mormons had accepted him. He said military force would not be needed. A few days later, two representatives of President Buchanan arrived. They brought news that the president would not act against Mormons who accepted the rule of the United States government. Brigham Young and the other Mormon leaders made a statement. They said they wished to live in peace under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. The dispute was over. Brigham Young continued to lead the Mormon Church, but the governor ruled the territorial government. The two jobs were separate and would remain that way.
Congressional elections were held in the United States in 1858. One political race created national interest. It was for one of the two Senate seats representing the state of Illinois. The candidate of the Democratic Party was Stephen Douglas. He was running for re-election. His opponent was a lawyer and a member of the Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. That will be our story next time.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.